Good evening, everyone. Welcome to 2,000 Years, the Jewish Odyssey. Tonight we're looking at the 18th century, part 18. We are sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilui Nishmas Yonah, Ben Rav Aryeh Leib. The repercussions of the twin tragedies of the 17th century, the Chmelnytsky massacres and the Shabtai Tzvi heresies, combined with the latter, the sacrilege of Benedict Spinoza, would extend far into the 18th century and beyond, in a sense, to today as well. The Jewish world was roiled by these, and the dust never really settled, and many subsequent events were defined or misdefined, as we'll see tonight, by reference to that sorry past, and it made the 18th century a magnet for controversy and strife, which it was. As the world turned against us, we turned against each other. The 18th century was defined by its controversies, not by its cell phones, but by its controversies, many of which involved great people. So first, let's look at Rabbi Yaakov Emden, 1697 to 1776. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was born in Germany. He was the son of a Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi is, I noted the other day on Shavuos night, known only for one thing today, and that is his, one day Yom Tov for visitors from the exile. But Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi was a very strong-minded individual. He didn't mind at all bucking the trends. He was an independent thinker. At a very young age, he moved to Salonika, where he learned and he became a Chacham in the Sephardic sense. Hence the title he used the rest of his life, Chacham Tzvi, until he established himself back in Germany, in Altona, in a Beis Medrash that he founded. Now his first wife and son were killed by the Austrian army. He remarried, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden was one of his sons. He became the co-rav in what was called the three towns, the Ahu towns in Germany, Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. Whenever you have co-rabbonim, it never works out as you would fantasize that it might, and he in fact was in very uneasy coexistence with the other Rav. Eventually he resigned. Eventually he became the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazim in Amsterdam. That too didn't work out, as the Chacham Tzvi maintained a fierce independence, and he saw his role as Rav as being an absolute authority. So, for example, when a Sephardi Kabbalist, Rav Nechemiah Chia Chayun, visited Amsterdam and sought to publicize his writings, the Chacham Tzvi opposed him on grounds that he immediately determined, and remembering, he thought, the fellow from Salonika, that he had alleged Shabtai Tzvi influences, and Chacham Tzvi put him in Cheirem. When he relented, apparently to someone else, it was too late. After this, this is just the culmination of many, many events that had troubled the community, that rose up again in anger against the Chacham Tzvi, tried to depose him. He was put in Cheirem, never good fate for a Rav. He had to flee to London secretly, and then eventually became the Rav in Lemberg. But as tough as he was, compared to his son, the Chacham Tzvi was a shrinking violet. Rabbi Yaakov Emden followed his father to Altona and to Amsterdam, but he first came to prominence as the Rav of Emden, Germany, hence the name. He didn't last long in the rabbinate either. He was also too strong-willed. He returned to Altona, where he opened up his own private shul, always a good business for a Jew, and then he went into the jewelry business, an even better business for a Jew, becoming wealthy. Wherever he went, Rabbi Yaakov Emden had a talent for antagonizing the local rabbonim. He was a Talmud Chacham, he was a maverick, he was a free thinker. He in fact wrote a tshuva saying that if it was up to him alone, he would abolish the ban on polygamy, because we don't have to be governed by what the Christians say. I don't know what his wife said about it. He was also wealthy enough to be unafraid of any consequences, and so he could not be controlled. When he received a grant from the King of Denmark, who was the sovereign in the area, to open up his own printing press in Altona, so Yaakov Emden couldn't be stopped. It's like a blogger today. He could disseminate what he wanted, when he wanted, so he became a constant critic of everything in Jewish life. Every community needs one. Some have hundreds. But he was the one, and he could just write as often as he wanted and publish. So the freelance rabbi is always a communal danger because he's answerable to no one, and he could dispense advice, and even psak halacha without consequences. We have it today as well. But today the danger is kulos and heterim. Then the danger was feuds. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden's first and most famous target was Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, 1690 to 1764. It's another great Talmud Chacham, who's a Dayan first in Prague, and later he became the Rav of those three towns, Ahu. What happened generally was that anyone who held his father's previous position from which he had to leave was never able to endear himself to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, so he had an immediate opponent of someone who lived in the town, and that would be any Rav. But at the heart of their dispute, beginning in 1751, was Rabbi Yaakov Emden's accusation that Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz was also a closet Shabtai Tzvi supporter. Now, he was emboldened in this charge when he came into possession of certain amulets that Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz had written for cholim, people who were sick, in line with the custom of the time and how Rabbanim often treated simple people. They treat simple people that way today also, unfortunately. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden said that Yonasan Eibeshitz wrote what he wrote in the amulets contained concealed Shabtai Tzvi formulas or references. He made other accusations against Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz involving sexual misconduct. Almost all the Rabbonim in Europe became a major cause celeb, sided with Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden was forced for a time to flee Altona for his life. Eventually the king of Denmark guaranteed his safe return, but the feud continued even after Rabbi Yonasan died. The irony is that they're buried within a few feet of each other in Hamburg, because one died, was buried right by Erev Shabbos, didn't have time to find a different grave. In retrospect, the charges seem crazy. Rabbi Yonasan was a gadol b'Torah who had himself, while in Prague, put Shabtai Tzviers in Cherem. But in fact, his own son did embrace Sabbateanism, and the use of amulets and Rabbi Yonasan's immersion in Kabbalah didn't help his cause. But almost all the evidence indicates that the charges were baseless, but they echoed the spirit of the times. For many people, you couldn't pick up a rock without finding a potential supporter of Shabtai Tzvi underneath it. And no doubt the feud was stoked by the followers of each, and many European Gedolim held that left alone, they would have resolved it on their own. Dan l'kaf schus. It's probably not true, because Rabbi Yaakov Emden had other enemies too. Another target of his was the great Ramchal. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was born in Padua in Italy. He lived a short life, relatively, 1707 to 1747. He's a great genius. He became a young student of Kabbalah, and he even claimed heavenly communications that he was receiving. At a very young age, he wrote the acclaimed Mesilas Yesharim, which became one of the classics of Musar. It's studied today, that people study it constantly. The Gra himself, the Gomi Vilna, said he read it, I think the story is, seven times, and didn't find even one extra word in the whole Sefer. Mesilas Yesharim, the path of the just, loosely follows the stages of spiritual ascent. The Gemara lists of Pinchas ben Yoyer, this, Bali Devat, etc., until you reach the highest level of Gemara, but Kedusha is the highest level, holiness. So the book, in the introduction, the Ramchal writes that he's writing nothing new at all in all his whole sefer, but he wants to simply remind people, Eis hayadul hem kvar, what people already know about the way they should live. And the book begins with a very oft-repeated statement of the Bali Musar that the foundation of all saintliness and the root of all perfection in God's service is that a man who a man has to clarify and recognizes the truth. To what end should he direct his vision and aspiration in everything he does in life? What is our obligation in the world? It's a remarkable work. The Bali Musar, 100, 150, and 200 years later, until today, even begin Musar Shmuzes with that basic idea in order to ascertain for a person, Ma Chavaso Be'olamo, what is it that God wants from us? And he wrote other remarkable works as well. Again, remarkable considering his age. The Derech Hashem, the Das Tehunas. He too ran afoul of the anti-Shabtai squads because of his embrace of Kabbalah and his own uniqueness. Ramchal, a lot of people don't know this, but Chassam Sofer wrote it in the Tshuva, was clean-shaven. It was also unusual by standards of Jews, and he also held no rabbinic position either. So he too was attacked for his alleged Shabtai ties, first by Rav Moshe Chagiz, whose father, Rav Yaakov Chagiz, had been a strenuous opponent in the flesh of Shabtai Tzid, and then again by Rav Yaakov Emden. In this case, the Ramchal had to flee Italy, then he had to flee Germany, went to Amsterdam to live, he became a lens grinder, oddly enough what Spinoza had done as well to earn a meager living, and a diamond polisher before the Ramchal moved to Eretz Yisrael in the 1740s, in fact in 1746, when he was 39, and he died just a year later. He's buried in Tveria near Rabbi Akiva's grave in the ancient cemetery. But the fear of another Shabtai Tzvi debacle was pervasive, and I think it's very difficult for us to relate to that entirely. And in the 18th century, it was certainly exacerbated by the Yaakov Frank episode, a potential repeat of the earlier calamity. Yaakov Frank, 1726 to 1791, claimed to be the reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi, which didn't impress those who didn't believe in either reincarnation or Shabtai Tzvi. He was from the Ukraine. He was the son of a Shabtai Tzvinik, and in the 1750s, he began to preach. He claimed to speak in Shabtai Tzvi's name. He wasn't a rav, wasn't that great a Talmid Chacham either, but he called on his followers to convert to Christianity. He, in fact, created a new religion, Yaakov Frank, which combined elements of Judaism and Christianity. That antagonized the Polish Catholic Church where he was preaching, and he was jailed for 13 years. When he came out unrepentant, he succeeded in converting probably 20,000 Jews to be his followers. Many, but not all of them, baptized themselves, but his movement attracted fame or infamy, but not much else. Especially when he turned on the Jewish people, even joined in a blood libel against the Jews, and confirmed to the church that, yes, Jews use the blood of Christians in their matzos. So he was a very odd figure. He didn't have the same sway or persuasive abilities that Shabtai Tzvi had, but in the spirit of the times, when the whole Frank episode arose and collapsed, it just added fuel to several other fires. By the way, the famous composer, Frederick Chopin, he was a Frankist, from a Frankist family. And there was another imbroglio that consumed a good part of the Jewish world. I spoke about this a few months ago at a Shal Shudis, and that's the famous controversy, the Get of Cleves. So just briefly, in 1766, a couple married in Mannheim, Germany. Within a few weeks, the husband began to exhibit strange behavior, including running off on Shabbos. I think it was Shabbos Sheva Brachos even. He ran off with a dowry and ran to a farm, took a wagon to a farm hours away, claiming the government was chasing him. Shortly thereafter, the couple decided to return to her hometown, Bonn, but again, fearing persecution, he talked her into going with him to London, but en route, they decided that just 3.5 weeks into the marriage, it's best for them to divorce. So in the town of Cleves, on the German-Dutch border, he gave her a get in front of the Basin of Cleves, administered by the Basin of Cleves. After financial settlement and with her get, she returned to Bonn and he continued to London. Well, his parents, objected to the financial settlement, and at their behest, the Basin in Mannheim and then in Frankfurt reviewed the circumstances oddly without interviewing the parties, and declared the man a shota, and declared the get invalid, and so she could not remarry until he gave her a get. It's a tremendous storm. Rabbanim from across Europe weighed in, most supported, including, of course, Rav Yaakov Emden, who wrote about it, the Chagas Aryeh. In fact, Rav Yaakov Emden's son in London interviewed the Chassan and said he's not a shota at all. So they validated the get, and the Jewish world is in turmoil. So I went into it in greater depth a few months ago. As the dispute raged on, though, the Chassan left London, returned to Germany, and what we say is the triumph of hope over experience, the couple remarried, ending the dispute, saying, apparently, for the first time at a wedding, Hare at od mikudeshesli bitabazo, because in fact they could not admit that the get was valid. On the other hand, the Habichoshesh forget as well. It was just a sign of the turmoil that would embroil the century, none greater and more lasting than the feud of Hasidim and Misnagdim. So the origins of the Hasidic movement are also shrouded in mystery. Its founder, Yisrael ben Eliezer, was born around 1700 in Poland. He was orphaned at a young age, and he was essentially unknown and unheralded, even after he married the sister of a noted Talmud Chacham, Rav Avram Gershon Kitover. He, Rav Yisrael, began to lead a group of followers into the Carpathian Mountains, where they lived in splendid isolation, communing with God and absorbing his teachings. At the age of 36, he, so to speak, revealed himself. He began traveling throughout Poland and Galicia, preaching, teaching almost a new brand of Judaism, and attracted a following. Of course, his followers would say he was a miracle worker as well, calling himself the Baal Shem Tov. What the Baal Shem Tov posited was revolutionary back then, even if they no longer surprise us today, we're somewhat used to it. He, the Baal Shem Tov, perceived the discontent of the common Jew, who was basically not learned. So what the Baal Shem Tov did, first and foremost, was de-emphasize the study of Torah as the means of serving God, and in its place, he created an Avodas Hashem that was marked by constant joy and an awareness of God's presence. So for Hasidim, Tefillah took on a new significance as the primary way by which a person can draw near to God, and so there's an emphasis on Tefillah. And Hasidic prayer was marked by singing and dancing and drinking and smoking and shaking and even acrobatics. Whatever a person needed to get into the spirit, some of the old-timers would do somersaults if it would help them help their kavana. Not the old-timers, but I mean the original Hasidim. He endorsed daily immersion in the mikvah, a service of God that was noted for Dveikus. Now much of this was unknown to Jewish life, and so the reaction of the Jewish establishment was swift and brutal, especially because the early Hasidim took liberties with certain halachos. Most famously, they disregarded Zmanei Tefillah. You had to say Shema by a certain time, a Davin Shacharis, a Mincha Maariv at a certain time. You're not in the mood, you're not in the mood. You have to wait to get... your mood matters more than the halachos of Zmanei Tefillah. If you want to know what, if you went to Brooklyn, so now it's 9:05. If you went to Brooklyn 9:45 tonight, you can still catch in some places a minyan for Mincha. That's how they operate. I was once davening a shtibul in Queens, we'll mention the name, and we finished Maariv, and a guy walked in and said, I need a hechadusha for Mincha. It did not matter, Zmanei Tefillah, it did not matter at all. They rejected the halacha that there's a chiyuv sukkah, chiyuv yeshiva b'sukkah and shmini atzeres, pretty explicit in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch, in the exile, allegedly because the Baal Shem Tov lived an Eretz Yisrael existence, so to speak, didn't need sukkah on the eighth day of atzeres. They created their own siddur, creating what was called the Nusach Ari. They extensively studied Kabbalah, which of course also provoked the Shabtai Tzvi accusations. The Baal Shem Tov proposed a new way of sharpening knives that many held rendered the knife a pogum, defective with each shechita, how the world changes. Then Chassidish shechita was problematic. Today it's considered desirable. Who could figure? They also started to break away from the established communities and shuls, founding their own shtiblach, which is always a problem in Jewish life. So in that sense, they were separatists. And of course, in a very important deviation, they elevated the Rebbe, known as the Tzaddik, to a status of almost an intermediary between man and God. And that was considered heretical, because a staple of Jewish faith is that every person can approach God directly. We don't need an intermediary at all. And of course, the depreciation of Talmud Torah is the central Jewish religious experience. And the red flag of Kabbalah that branded them potential Shabtai Tzviers enraged the opponents of Hasidus, who became known as Misnagdim, as the opponents. In 1756, aware of all these currents, the Vlad Arba Artzos in Poland decreed that no man under 40 may study Kabbalah by edict of the Vlad Arba Artzos, but this edict was disregarded by the Hasidim. It was a tumultuous era. When the Besh died in 1760, he left behind no writings and only the rudimentary framework of a movement. That movement was nourished into a powerful force by Rav Dov Baer of Mezrich, the Maggid of Mezrich, who was one of his prime disciples. He trained all the people who would become the leaders of Hasidus, who would popularize it across Europe, each and every one of them a colorful and unique personality. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, whose work Toldos Yaakov Yosef, with the Besh's teachings, was the only contemporaneous account of anything the Besh ever said or did. Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhensk, the Chose of Lublin, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Rebbe of Lubavitch, 1745-18 Chovel played such a central role in both the development of Hasidus and all the fights that went on. And Rav Nachman of Breslov, 1772-1810, Rav Nachman died when he was 38. He was the only one who was an heir of the Baal Shem Tov. He was the Baal Shem Tov's great-grandson, Rav Nachman of Mitzvah Gadol Leos Pesimcha fame. So he opposed, he was also a maverick, he opposed the notion of a hereditary dynasty, that each movement or each faction, the Rebbe would be succeeded by his son. He opposed that. He died without a living child, so his Hasidim, the Breslov of Hasidim, came to be known as the Taiter Hasidim, the dead Hasidim, because they serve a dead Rebbe. He was never replaced. Now people call them other things too, but for centuries they were called the Taita Hasidim. That's important to know. The movement was never monolithic, and all these Rebbes that I mentioned, completely different personalities. They were not all the same. Some had come from traditional Talmud Torah-oriented backgrounds, and in fact it was the Alter Rebbe of Lubavitch, Rav Shneur Zalman, who did much to restore the centrality of Talmud Torah to Hasidic life. So in 1770 he was tasked by the Maggid of Mezrich with updating the Shulchan Aruch and conforming it to current needs, including some of their minhagim and practice as well. And the product on the Shulchan Aruch Harav was a major halachic work. Of course, he's much better known for that Lubavitch staple, the Tanya. So he is widely known as the Bala Tanya or the Alter Rebbe. The Tanya is technically called Likutei Amorim, a collection of sayings. Is a masterpiece, a work about Kabbalah and human psychology and Hasidic thought, about infusing religious life with intellectual substance, about permeating one's mind and soul with an awareness of God. So in that it differed somewhat from traditional Hasidic thought, but it found a wider audience. One tidbit, a little something if you want to win a trivia bet. All the later Rebbes were from a family known as Schneerson, son of Schneer, from Schneur Zalman. They're all part of the same family. The existence of the Hasidic movement would change Jewish life, but within a very short time pit Jew against Jew and community against community, involve the government as well, and bring into this this conflagration, probably the greatest figure of the 18th century and many others, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, known to us as the Gaon or the Gra, Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu, or simply the Gaon of Vilna, 1720 to 1797. He was a stupendous Talmud Chacham to which accolades are superfluous. He's just known as the Gaon. And really since then, and frankly from time of the Gaonim, there's no one who is known as the Gaon. Now, you know, people toss around the Gaon with every guy's mentioned in the newspaper. But when you say the Gaon in the Jewish world, everybody knows who you're talking about. We cannot fully appreciate or even describe the extent or depth of his genius. Like, it's not within our ken. He was proficient in every area of knowledge, Torah, Kabbalah, Halacha, in secular studies, as an autodidact, science and math and medicine, philosophy, music. The Gaon said famously, a person that doesn't understand music cannot really understand what kavona in tefillah is. Something to think about, because it has an effect on, both have an effect on the soul. He said, one who lacks secular knowledge lacks a hundredfold that in Torah knowledge, which was later interpreted to mean, that's for the Gaon and no one else. But in fact, that's how he saw the world. His student, Baruch of Shklov, for example, translated Euclid's the elements of geometry into Hebrew to make it easier for the disciples of the Gaon to study. The Gaon gave his first public shiur at the age of 8. He'd finished Shas long before his bar mitzvah, but not the, you know, reading, the Shas with Rishonim and the Acharonim to date. He wrote dozens of Sfarim through his life. He was the authority and leader of the Jewish people. Even though he never held a formal position, he was never even the Rav of Vilna, much less the Rosh Yeshiva. He was renowned for his piety as much as for his scholarship. The Gaon was totally devoted to Talmud Torah for most of his life, sleeping just 2 hours of every 24 in 30-minute increments every 5-6 hours or so. He himself edited the Talmud again, Haggadah HaGrah, traveling through Europe mainly for that purpose. He edited his commentaries to Shulchan Aruch, and he single-handedly maintained the primacy of Talmud Torah and of the Talmid HaChachamim in Europe. And in fact, he was responsible for the yeshiva movement that we'll get to next time as well. As such, although the Hasidim had to respect him, and they did, their ideology made him their natural opponent. The first organized opposition to Hasidus arose in 1772. Hasidim, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier, were placed in Cherem, the Shechita was banned, the Sfarim were publicly burned in Vilna. Occasionally over the ensuing decades, there was violence, and for many decades there'd be recriminations as well, Jews informing on other Jews to the authorities, simply because they were either Hasidim or Misnagdim, take whatever side you're on. In a sense, there's an undercurrent of that tension today as well. You know, these jokes of Hasidim and Misnagdim still pepper Jewish life, but in a more substantive sense, you go back 25 years, and the two Torah-oriented parties in Israel split, Agudas Yisrael and Degel HaTorah, Agudas Yisrael being the Hasidic group, Degel HaTorah being the Lithuanian Yeshivish group, and alright, eventually they rejoined, but even today they exist in a very uneasy union. So it still carries on today. There were excommunications after 1772 in almost every decade for the next half century, and counter-Cherems as well. The Hasidim would put the Misnagdim in Cherem too. There was a bright side to all of this. What's the bright side? So no less a personage than the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, held that but for the opposition of the Gra, Hasidus would have corrupted itself. And it would have, and led by some radicals, it might have gone off the deep end and permanently uprooted certain Torah principles. So paradoxically, the Gra kept it in the fold, as Hasidic leaders, especially the Baal HaTanya, had to respond to their charges. But it didn't make it easier at the time, and there were counter charges as well. Like I said, the girl never was a Rosh Yeshiva, never had a yeshiva, just sat and learned. But he did have a cadre of disciples who surrounded him and learned with him, the leading one being Chaim Volozhiner, mainly in response to Chassidus, and especially in response to the Tanya. Reb Chaim wrote the classic Nefesh HaChaim about the primacy of Talmud Torah, weaving together ideas about the immanence of God and the effect that every one of our actions has on the universe, not just on each other, and the power of the individual Jew, as opposed, of course, to a Rebbe. Feuds have a tendency to go over the edge, and this one certainly did. The Gaon Mivilna died on Yutes Tishrei, Chol HaMoed, Sukkos in 1797. That night in Vilna, Hasidim rejoiced at a Simchas Beis HaShoeva. They said they did not know that the Gra had died. The Misnagdim held they were rejoicing over the Gra's death. So the Jewish Council of Vilna took to persecuting the Hasidim of Vilna, beating them in public, forcing them to recant their Hasidus. What sad echoes, because think back just a few centuries, this had been done to Jews by Christians. In response, the Hasidim informed on the Jewish Community Council to the Russian government, and the Russian government curtailed their powers, and in the summer of 1798, some Vilna officials were even arrested. In response to that, the Misnagdim informed the government that Rav Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe, was guilty of currency violations, of illegally sending money to an enemy state. In sum and substance, it was true. The Alter Rebbe was sending money to the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, then under Turkish rule, the Ottoman Empire being then a sworn enemy of Russia. So it was technically true. The Alter Rebbe was arrested. He was incarcerated in St. Petersburg for 53 days. When I was in Russia 2 years ago, I visited the prison where he was held, until he was released on Yud-Tes Kislev in 1798, a date celebrated by Chabadniks until today. The response to this was such outrage against the Misnagdim that the Vilna Jewish Council was dismissed by the government, and a new council, all Hasidim, because the election was manipulated, all Hasidim were elected as the new heads of the Vilna Jewish community. Irony of ironies, just 2 years after the Gaon Mivilna, that great Misnagid had died. Even that didn't end the feud. By the way, the Alter Rebbe was cleared of the charges, but he was arrested yet again in 1800. Those charges were also dismissed. I was in Milan, it was last summer, in the Davening with Chabad Shuls, and they didn't say Tachlin one day. So I said it myself. I said, why say Tachlin? So the Chassid said, because today is the day the Rebbe was freed from prison. So I said that that's not true. He was freed on Yud-Tes Kislev. We were there in July. So he said, no, he was arrested another time. I said, how many times was your Rebbe arrested? But it turns out he was actually freed in December of 1790. I'm sorry, December of 1800. So in fact, the guy was just playing with me. Those charges were also dismissed, and the two sides, though, remained in troubled relations for the better part of a century. While the Jews were feuding, the non-Jews were plotting. In 1772, the country of Poland was dismembered and ceased to exist. In fact, Poland ceased to be an independent nation from 1772 until after World War I, when it was recreated. Its territory carved up by Prussia, Austria, and Russia. What became known as Russian Poland, under the auspices of Tsarina Catherine the Great, became known as the Pale of Settlement. It was created as the residence for Jews in Western Russia, Pale meaning boundary. Jews who lived outside the Pale were then uprooted, forced to live inside the Pale. Russia wanted Poland's territory, but they did not want its Jews. So Polish Jewry, as well as much of Russian Jewry, were forced for the next century and a half to live in this small area. Jews with special permits or physicians, for example, or have had other talents that were needed elsewhere, could live elsewhere in very limited numbers. And even in the Pale, Jews were barred from cities, creating then for themselves small towns that were called shtetls. I should mention that Jews were barred from living in Moscow, for example, or St. Petersburg, for example. Even though you find already 19th century Jews there, depending on what they contribute to society, they would be allowed to live. But technically they were not allowed to live in any of these areas until first late 19th century, and then after the communists came to power. The concentration of Jews in the Pale is astounding. At one time, 40% of the world's Jewish population, that's 5 million people, one century hence, lived in the Pale of Settlement. And that life in the Pale of Settlement was both enriching and impoverishing. It was enriching spiritually, as in the 19th century, yeshivos would flourish and Jews would create a very rich spiritual life. But it was impoverishing in almost every other way. Literally, economic and employment opportunities were very limited. Physically, Jews became easy targets of pogroms because the geographical area was relatively small, and politically as well, they were closed out of the general society. All of this would have a very deleterious effect in the 19th century. But in fact, in the 18th century, other havens presented themselves to Jews in a remarkable way. In 1700, the year 1700, in the wake of all the turmoil of the 17th century, a Jew named Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid left Poland for Israel, first with a handful of families. En route, he attracted maybe 1,000 or 1,500 other Jews to join him to make Aliyah. Many died en route. He himself, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, died shortly after arriving in Yerushalayim, where generally his followers would not welcome. The community there, mainly Sfardim, some Ashkenazim, was poor enough, subsisting on handouts from the Jewish world. The last thing they wanted was hundreds of more mouths to feed. His followers, after he died, built a small shul, named it after him, but unable to repay their debts, the shul was destroyed by Arabs in 1720, Sefer Torah burned. It was rebuilt in 1810, destroyed again by the Jordanians in 1948, known then and today as Churvat Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, the Churva Shul in the Old City, now marked by an arch that overhangs its location. For most of its existence, it was the main Ashkenazi shul in Yerushalayim. After the shul was destroyed in 1720, the Sfardim got together and banned Ashkenazim from living in Yerushalayim altogether, because Ashkenazim did not want to comply with their minhagim and other issues as well, a ban that lasted more than a century. So Ashkenazim then went to settle in the three other holy cities, Hebron, Tzfat, and Tveria. Meanwhile, in the 1750s, the aforementioned of Avram Gershon Kitova, the brother-in-law of the Baal Shem Tov, made Aliyah, establishing the first Hasidic enclave in Hebron. The Hasidic masters, becoming mainstays of the Ashkenazic community and dictating the Hasidic masters, encouraged Aliyah, as did the Gra. And the Gra students began arriving in Israel in the early 19th century, becoming the mainstays of the Ashkenazic community, and in fact dictating the customs of that community in Yerushalayim and elsewhere, Minag HaGra, until today. So this is not simply finding a place to live. The Gaon Mevilna felt and believed very deeply that the Messianic era was beginning and that the return to Israel would move that process forward. There had to be Hisoros Militato. We had to arouse the Messianic process. His disciple, Rabbi Hillel of Shklov, wrote the classic Kol HaTor about the impending redemption that contained many of the thoughts and allusions of the Gaon Mevilna to the process of Geula In fact, much of it reads like the program of the last century. All of this, by the way, would add a layer of tension when the Zionist movement began, as they did not return to an empty land, but a land that had pious Jews already living there, and in fact resented their arrival. Keep in mind, at the very end of the century, Napoleon Bonaparte conquered part of Israel in 1799, but he met his first Waterloo, so to speak, at Akko. He could not penetrate the fortress walls of Akko that stymied him, so he was repulsed. Meanwhile, the Jewish population in America increased by the time of the American Revolution to the low thousands. In the middle part of the century, Ashkenazim began to arrive. Shuls were built in New York, Newport, Rhode Island. All of those shuls still exist, Eretz Yisrael, and now it's called the Torah Synagogue, and Mikve Yisrael in Philadelphia, to which Ben Franklin himself gave a £5 donation. They have the receipt that they gave him still hanging in the museum there. Jews were active in the revolution. They're very small numbers. One famous personality, Chaim Salomon, 1740-1785, a Polish Jew who became one of the financiers of the revolution. He's a member of Mikve Yisrael in Philadelphia. He raised money for the revolution. Reports say he even went broke donating his own money. It was never repaid. But religious life in America was lax. There are very few rabbis, no yeshivos. But the novelty of a land which in 1787, at its constitutional convention, would guarantee freedom of religion, was not lost on American Jews, nor on Jews across the world. And even if the First Amendment limited only Congress and certain benefits for decades after independence pertained only to Christians, in time that too would change. In Europe, in Western Central Europe, Jews suffered under the cruelty and relentless Jew hatred of the otherwise celebrated Empress Maria Theresa of Austria-Hungary. She even banned them from Prague and other cities at one point. But she was succeeded by her son, Joseph II, in 1781, and he was a different spirit. He abolished her decrees of special taxes for Jews, yellow badges for Jews. He even permitted Jews in university and even into the army as well. The Jewish quarter in Prague is named Josefov in his honor because he was held to be a friend of Jews. And a new spirit of openness was wafting through Europe that would entice and threaten our people as well. One of them was another fascinating personality from the 18th century, and that was Moses Mendelssohn. 1729 to 1786, a German Jew who heralded a movement that would change Jewish life dramatically in the 19th and 20th centuries, the Enlightenment. He was a Talmud Chacham, educated in yeshivos, educated also in secular studies in Berlin. He became an acclaimed philosopher and a believer in the central tenet of the Enlightenment, that reason and science, more than revealed religion, would lead to a better, more peaceful world. He was an observant Jew, but although he didn't coin the phrase, he embodied its ideology, be a Jew at home and a human being in the street. To him, religion was a private matter, and Jews would be more integrated, more welcome into German society if only they opened up to it. Essentially, he rejected the concept of an amanivchar, of a practical return to the land of Israel, and of the uniqueness of Torah as well. Wittingly or unwittingly, he paved the way for the Reform movement, for the entree of the Haskalah into Jewish life, for increased conversions to Christianity. It's not only his famous grandson, Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, but in fact, and it's shocking if you think about it, because Mendelssohn was a Talmud Chacham and he was a Shomer Mitzvos, but four of his six children converted to Christianity. Responsible also for fostering in some way rampant assimilation in Western Europe, to some extent the rise of biblical criticism as well, and in thinking that acculturation would endear Jews to Germans and vice versa, he was dead wrong and deadly wrong. In translating the Torah into German, one of his great works, the Biur, in Hebrew characters, he introduced a whole generation of Jews to the German language and culture and literature, and that would ultimately devastate them as well. He was challenged by many of the giants of the age, among them the great notable Yehuda, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau of Prague, 1713 to 1793. He was perhaps the leading posek of the era. Even though you had a Gaon Mivilna in that era, the notable Yehuda put the beer in Cheirem and challenged Mendelssohn numerous times. His Shailos and Tshuvos, the note of Yehuda, is widely referenced today, and on many issues, autopsies for example, he's often the first source that we turn to because he dealt with this in a very modern setting. A little before the note of Yehuda, he had Rabbi Yehoshua Falk, wrote the classic commentary on the Gemara, the Pnei Yehoshua. There are other legendary giants, in addition to the ones mentioned earlier, that made it such a rich century in that sense. Reb Chaim Ibn Attar, author of the Or HaChaim on Chumash, 1696 to 1743, was Moroccan origin. He also moved to Eretz Yisrael. The Shulchan Aruch was supplemented, in a sense completed, as we have it today, with the Bar Hetev and the Pri Chodosh and the Pri Megadim, all 18th century Ashkenazi works. And for Sfardim, of course it came into our world as well, Rabbi Yehuda Rosenz in Turkey wrote the Mishnah Lamelech on the Rambam, and his student Rabbi Yaakov Kuli wrote the Me'amloes in Ladina. We have it, of course, today in both Hebrew and English translations. It was a great Jew, tremendous Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Arya Leib Ginsburg, 1695. Rabbi Arya Leib Ginsburg, 1695-1785, wrote the classic Shagas Aryeh on different halachic topics. Another wonderful Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Arya Leib HaKohen Heller, 1745-1813, known to us as the Ksos, wrote the Ksos HaChoshen, HaChoshen Mishpat, Avnei Miluim on Evin HaEzer, and the Shev Shmaitza. All these people, you could just spend the shiur on stories about them. Rabbi Arya Leib HaKohen Heller, the Ksos, came as a young man with his Ksos HaChoshen to ask the Vilna Beis Din for a Haskama for his Sefer. So busy dealing with an Aguna case, very difficult case. He sat and listened and left his Sefer behind. He came back like early 6-5 the next morning, and the head of the Beis Din was there, said, "I had no chance to look at your Sefer because we're researching this Aguna issue." So the Ksos said to him, "I also was up the whole night. I wrote a tshuva about this case, and here it is." So in fact, he not only freed the Aguna, but he was able to get his Askam as well. With all that, he lived in dire poverty, but in a poor generation, dire poverty. He wrote on a board held up by two barrels. He often had no wood even to heat his furnace in the winter. So he wrote his Sfarim under his blanket, so the ink would not freeze as he was writing. That was his life. Complete dedication to Torah. Rabbi Yaakov Reischer wrote the Shvus Yaakov, known to generations of yeshiva students as the Shvus Yaakov. Rabbi Yechiel Halperin wrote the Seder Hadoros, a history of the world, from the time of creation, with a brief mention of every Tana and Amora in Shas. One very colorful genius was the Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, 1724-1807, born in Yerushalayim, wrote dozens of works, and traveled throughout Europe as a shaliach, and then a mashulach, for Eretz Yisrael and for its yeshivos. The last time he journeyed, in the 1770s, he stayed in Livorno, on the western coast of Italy, where most of his books were published, Livorno having a major Jewish publishing house for several centuries, and there he died and was buried as well. I think though his body was taken to Israel in 1960 or so. Rabbi Yaakov Kranz enthralled audiences across Europe with his clever expositions of Torah, and his ethical observations became known to us as the Dubna Magid. And the two major commentaries on the Yerushalmi, the Pnei Moshe and the Karban HaEdah, were also published in the 18th century. All this amid the usual run of persecutions, devastating fires in many, many cities and towns, occasional plagues as well that also took much Jewish life, and forced baptisms inspired by the evil Pope Pius VI. in the last quarter of the century. With all that, the 18th century saw the scholarship of the Gra, the Chidah, the Ksos, the Shagas Aryeh, the Nogu the Yehuda, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Yomisinus Naibshitz, the Baal Shem Tov, the Magid, the Berditcheva, and many, many others stand out for the geniuses whose works enrich us until today. But in fact, the 18th century stands out mostly as a century of strife among Jews, with Rabbi Yaakov Emden and Rabbi Yonasan and the Ramchal and the Hasidim and the Misnagdim and the Get of Cleves and all the others. And Moses Mendelssohn opened the door to the world that Jews have been trying unsuccessfully to close or at least regulate ever since. Meanwhile, the Pale of Settlement and its political dangers loomed in the distance, along with reform and enlightenment, the ideal of emancipation brought to the world by the American and French revolutions, and by the political reforms of Maria Theresa's son, Joseph II, in Prague and Vienna, and the stirring of the land of Israel, as all the modern challenges, or the challenges of modern times, they all began to take shape in the 18th century. More on this next time as we look at the 19th century. Thank you very much.